Good evening, everyone. My name is Kendall Crolius, and I'm one of the many volunteers from Reading Odyssey and the Darwin 150 Project who are producing this program. I'm in just a moment going to give a brief introduction for our speaker, Jonathan Weiner, who will speak for approximately 40 minutes, and we will then open this up to questions and answers from the audience here at Columbia and around the world. Again, the email for questions is pterry@readingodyssey.com. I am absolutely thrilled to welcome Jonathan Weiner to be our speaker tonight. Jonathan is an award-winning author who has a really special and unique gift for making science accessible to general audiences. And as an English major, I appreciate that more than I can tell you.
His books have won countless awards, and his book, The Beak of the Finch, I hope he's going to sign my copy tonight,
won the Pulitzer Prize.
Jonathan is a professor in the Graduate School of Journalism here at Columbia University. We are honored to have him give this lecture. Please join me in welcoming Jonathan Weiner.
Thank you very much, Kendall, and many thanks to you, Phil. Phil, Terry, and I have had many talks on the telephone, and this is the first time we've met this evening. I'm sorry. To the audience, I appreciate your moving three floors and staying with us. I'm sorry for the confusion there over the lecture hall. Those of you listening in haven't had to move around. I'm very glad that you're tuning in and listening. Thank you. It's an honor to be part of the Darwin 150 Project. It's a thrill to be able to participate in celebrations around the world of Darwin's 200th birthday and the 150th anniversary of the Origin of Species. I just wanted to add that if people are listening at Texas A&M and at Arizona State, I have friends there from visits some time back, and so I'll say hi. I'll tell you, when I started working on a book about evolution, I knew so little about the subject that I didn't even realize it was controversial. And I always like to start by saying that because I've been continuously surprised, given the nature of the project that brought me to the writing of a book about evolution, that it should be controversial, because I was looking over the shoulders of two extraordinary biologists at Princeton, Peter and Rosemary Grant, who watch evolution happen, watch evolution in action in Darwin's Islands with Darwin's finches. Darwin himself didn't think that you could do that. Darwin thought that evolution proceeds far too slowly for anybody to watch. And he says in a famous passage in The Origin, "It may metaphorically be said that natural selection is daily and hourly scrutinizing throughout the world the slightest variations, rejecting those that are bad, preserving and adding up all that are good, silently and insensibly working whenever and wherever opportunity offers. We see nothing of these slow changes in progress until the hand of time has marked the lapse of ages." Darwin certainly never saw evolution in action in the Galapagos Islands because he spent only 5 weeks there, 5 weeks in the fall of 1835. He arrived September 15th, 1835. He left late October, bound for Tahiti. And it was only after he got home that he began to realize that the variation he'd seen in birds, in iguanas, in tortoises, in cacti in the Galapagos Islands, might have had special significance. And in the book he wrote about his voyage around the world on the Beagle, Journal of Researches, now known as The Voyage of the Beagle, he wrote ruefully in his chapter about the islands, "It is the fate of most voyagers no sooner to discover what is most interesting in any locality than they are hurried from it." So Darwin spent a good part of his career reconstructing what he might have seen or what he might have been able to put together had he spent more time in the Galapagos Islands. And in The Origin of Species, he argues very logically and beautifully, you can still read the book with pleasure, that variation, the theme of our talk tonight, variation, is the cornerstone of all of the change that has produced the fabulous, fabulous variety we see around us in the Tree of Life. His first chapter, chapter one, is called Variation Under Domestication. And he begins with this very humble, very simple theme of variation, individual, minute variations, the kinds of individual variations that we see around the room right now. If we look around at each other's faces, we see variation. If you go to your family dinner table, you see variations. And if you look around at life in a barnyard, life in, if you look at a litter of puppies or a litter of kittens, you see variation, innumerable variations. And Darwin begins there. He talks about variations in wild duck bones, cow and goat udders, cats with blue eyes, hairless dogs, pigeons with shorter beaks, pigeons with longer beaks, variations everywhere. Body and instinct. Also, instinct varies. He talks about a dog in this first chapter whose great-grandfather, I quote, whose great-grandfather was a wolf, and this dog showed a trace of his wild parentage only in one way, by not coming in a straight line to his master when called. Isn't that a great line? And he notes that many, if not most, of these variations, like that one in the dog, are inherited and are passed down, as, again, you see around you at the family dinner table. He didn't know how they were inherited and passed down because he was living a century before Watson and Crick discovered the double helix, half a century before Thomas Morgan here at Columbia, Thomas Hunt Morgan, established the science of genetics in a laboratory in Skirmerhorn, which is only 2 minutes away from here. By the way, it was an undergraduate, 19 years old. I'm addressing this to the biologists of the collegiate school. A couple years older than you, decided that he could look at his professor's data. His professor was breeding fruit flies and looking at who got the white eyes, who got the red eyes. Some of you have been studying this. You've heard about it. Tracing the family tree through those white eyes, red eyes, ruby eyes, curly wings, bristly legs, a lot of variation even in fruit flies. He collects all of the data from the laboratory, or certain files of it. He takes it back to his dormitory room, 19 years old. He has homework. He decides he's not going to do the homework. Instead, he's going to look at all this variation and follow the family trees, and with a very brilliant puzzle-solving idea, which I can't go into now, but which was extraordinarily simple in retrospect, he could demonstrate not only that genes exist, that is, that all this variation that we see around us is encoded in bits like mosaic tiles, but on the level of the genes, not only could he do that, he could map them. He could show where in the fly's chromosomes that gene for white eyes, for instance, was located, and where for curly wings. So he produced, by pulling that all-nighter, the proof that there could be a science of inheritance, a true science of genetics, as it came to be called, and that you could make a map of the genes, which now reached a climax just recently in our time with the Human Genome Project. So all that in one all-nighter. Well,
don't do your homework, collegiate school biologist.
Yeah, that's right. If you're struck by an inspiration like that, your teacher will forgive you. Morgan was so impressed that he made Sturtevant a professor, this is some years later, at Caltech when he moved on to the California Institute of Technology. And Sturtevant's remembered as one of the great biologists, along with Morgan, of the 20th century. So all of these instincts and little variations in the body, in even in personality, are potentially heritable. They're not all inherited, but Darwin argued many, many of them are inherited. And this very simple fact, again, is the cornerstone of his entire argument. He calls the origin of species one long argument, and this is where the argument begins. He was a brilliant writer and a brilliant, in a quiet way, a brilliant arguer, because he's starting with something that we do all know. I keep mentioning the family dinner table. You also, you know, you're always thinking about what did you get from your father, what did you get from your mother, what might you have gotten from your grandfather, your grandmother. This is something I see in my family. My kids are both gifted in mathematics, and I'm sorry to say they didn't get it from me. But they got it from my father, who used to teach here at Columbia, and he taught applied mathematics. Both my kids got those genes. I didn't get those genes. And Darwin had a grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, who believed that the logical explanation for the diversity of life on Earth was a kind of family tree, starting with a few very early, very simple forms of life, and gradually evolving, though he didn't use that word, evolving into the fantastically diverse family tree of species that we see around us now. Erasmus Darwin thought that. Darwin, that's two generations before Charles. But Erasmus wrote about it in a long, now unreadable poem called Zoonomia. And he had no explanation for what might have caused the branching of the tree. He only had the conviction that that might explain the diversity of life on Earth. And there were other people, too, who believed that without being able to explain the mechanism. So Charles, as he started thinking after the voyage of the Beagle about the specimens he had collected in his voyage around the world, and particularly the mockingbirds and the finches that he had found in the Galapagos and that some of his shipmates had found, as he started thinking about the importance of variation and making notes in a lot of secret notebooks, with secret written on the cover of these notebooks, he noted at one point, "My handwriting, same as grandfather." Which must have been an eerie moment for him, because he's thinking about the way small variations in behavior and personality are passed down. He's thinking, revisiting his grandfather's theory, and he's beginning to think he's going to devote his life to one long argument to prove that it's correct. And he's noticing that his handwriting is very much like his grandfather's. So, variations. The first point that Darwin makes about variations, beyond their existence, their pervasiveness, the universality of variation, is that they're inherited. The second point he makes is that they can be selected. He doesn't use the term, the famous term now, natural selection, yet in introducing this concept. He's talking, remember, about variation under domestication. So he talks about variation as it's visible to breeders, breeders of dogs, breeders of cats, breeders of corn. They all select among variations. If there weren't variations, there would be nothing for them to select. And he talks about unconscious selection. There are unconscious acts of selection when breeders choose their favorite pup in a litter or their favorite kitten and choose those to breed. And he also speaks of natural selection. There are all kinds of variations that are being selected in the wild or being selected just out there in the sheep pen, in the pasture, that the breeder himself isn't aware of. The breeder isn't following. So then he says, the same thing must be going on everywhere in nature. And that's chapter 2 of The Origin, Variation in Nature. That's a subject that fascinated Rosemary Grant of Princeton as a child. She grew up in a village in the Lake District, and at the age of 4, she used to follow the old family gardener around, and she noticed that in any row of vegetables, no two were exactly alike. And all the trees around their house, the birches, the oaks, the beeches, they were all different, one from the next. She knew she had her favorite trees. All of the people in the village, everybody was different, all those variations. And Darwin made a special study of variation in barnacles, and he spent years on it. So many years that a son of his grew up taking it for granted that every father studied barnacles. And he went over to his friend's house once, and he got a tour of the house, and he said to his friend, "And where does your father do his barnacles?" So, variation, it's inherited. It's in every garden plot. It's in every forest around the garden plot. It's on every desert island. And then think of the pressure out there. That's chapter 3, struggle for existence. That's what makes variation so significant, so charged with significance for Darwin in his argument. If animals and plants vary, the slightest difference, as Darwin writes in The Origin, the smallest grain in the balance, in the long run, must tell on which death shall fall and who shall survive. So there, you know, he's talking about the deer that can run a little faster than the other deer, the wolf that can run a little faster than the other wolves, and those deer. Anybody know the old joke about the camp and the bear? Campers and a bear hear a bear approaching. It'd be nice if they heard a bear approaching. But it's a bear. They hear a bear, and one of them starts putting on his running shoes. And the other one says, "Are you crazy? You can't outrun a bear." And he says, "I don't have to outrun a bear. I just have to outrun you." So there are situations, Darwin says, where the slightest variation is going to become a matter of life and death. Darwin himself couldn't see that happening, but he argued that it had to happen, that it was only logical to assume that it happened and happened everywhere. And he writes, "What applies to one animal will apply throughout time to all animals, that is, if they vary, for otherwise natural selection can do nothing." So again, given the assumption of variation, it's only logical to conclude that there will be times, given the pressure of the struggle for existence, the struggle to get enough food, the struggle to stay warm through the night, the struggle to find a mate in our time, among our kind, if we are fortunate, we're much less aware often of the struggle for existence. We're still aware, just as keenly as ever, of the struggle to find a mate. Selection pressure of one kind or another is intense. And in the wild, or among domestic species, and among our own species, it operates in every generation, and individual variations, slight variations, can make all of the difference in whether you pass on your genes or you don't get to pass on your genes. So that's Darwin's argument, as simple as that, in The Origin of Species. That's the essence of it. But in his gradualistic view of geological change and of evolutionary change, it all takes place at the level that mountains are built, that rivers wear away canyons. It's all too slow to watch. And that's how most of us still think of evolution today, I think. Certainly that's how I thought of evolution when I first heard about Peter and Rosemary's work, which is why I was so surprised. And I have to say, from the moment I heard that they go to the Galapagos and watch this, I was so enthralled that, again, I got completely caught up in telling people the story and continually forgot how controversial a story it is. And I still remember the first time that happened that I got sort of a wake-up call about the controversy was at a family dinner table, as a matter of fact, It was a party in Allentown, Pennsylvania. My family lived in Allentown at the time. And I was talking at the table about this wonderful new story that I was going to write a book about, the study of evolution in action. And afterwards, someone came up to me by the coat closet at the end of the party and said, "Excuse me, did I hear you say you were writing about evolution?" And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "Are you for it or against it?"
And then a week later,
I was in the dentist's chair, and I was getting my teeth cleaned, and the dental hygienist, who was wearing one of those hygienic masks, and so was a little bit forbidding, but spoke through the mask and asked me, "What are you working on now? Did you find a new subject to write about?" And I said, "Yeah, evolution." And she bends really close to me, and she stares at me eyeballs to eyeballs, and she said, "Well, I'm a Jehovah's Witness, so you know what I think about that." And I didn't feel I was in any position to argue. And then I was finishing the book about the grants, The Beak of the Finch. I was finishing the book. I'd written the last chapter. I had pulled an all-nighter, not as earth-shattering as Alfred Sturtevant's all-nighter, but I was very proud of the results. I had a chapter, my last chapter, called God and the Galapagos, as a matter of fact, trapped in my computer. And my computer froze. A technical glitch. The computer froze. I couldn't print it out. I had to print out that chapter in time for the Federal Express drop-off. We didn't have email. This is early 1990s. I had to get it to the FedEx drop-off in my small town in Pennsylvania, and I couldn't print it out. So I called the local Apple store. By the way, talk about the importance of small variations. I hope everybody is an Apple fan here. And I called and I begged the guy who answered the phone. The place was already closed, but it was a technician, a tech repair guy. Would he let me in and would he save my chapter? And so he lets me into the store. I go in. Half an hour later, the computer is barfed all over the counter at Computer Forum in Doylestown. Now, he's got it under control. He's doing a beautiful job. I'm not too nervous. It's all going fine. And he looks up, and he says very sociably to me, you know, I'm sort of pacing around, and he says, "So what's your book about?" And I said, "Yeah, I still haven't heard." I said, "Evolution." And there's this awful silence again. And he says, "Well, I can tell you, and I have a PhD in engineering, and I know that this Earth was created, much as we see it now, within the last 5 or 6,000 years." So we just sort of look at each other, and I look down at the computer, barfed out on the counter, and out of wonderful charity in his heart, he just shrugs, and he goes back to work, and he saves the draft, and I printed it out. And the poor guy, I've told this story 12 zillion times since then, and I'm sure he's heard it himself once or twice. It was a very, very merciful act on his part. We agreed to disagree, and he saved the chapter. All right. So what is it that makes the grant study in the Galapagos so extraordinary? It's partly, I think, that Darwin himself didn't believe that you could see what they, in fact, can see, much as he intuited the importance of the islands. If you read The Voyage of the Beagle, which is terrific reading, it was a bestseller in his day. It was always his favorite book, by the way, much more important to him than The Origin, because it was his first and it was a bestseller. He says of the Galapagos, "Hence, both in space and time, we seem to be brought somewhat near to that great fact, that mystery of mysteries, the first appearance of new beings on this earth." But he's only collected a couple dozen finches, and he has no way of knowing that in the islands with the finches, you could demonstrate each of those simple steps that I just laid out, the steps in the origin, and you could show how vital variation is, and you could show it leading to evolution, not only within your lifetime, but within a single year. So this is what Peter and Rosemary found. They went to the Galapagos in 1973 for the first time. They pitched camp on this little desert island called Daphne Major in the middle of the archipelago, an island that's such a little speck of rock that Darwin himself never even saw it from the Beagle. They began studying Darwin's finches, and they assumed, as Darwin had assumed, that they would have to infer the evolutionary process from the variations that they were measuring in the birds. They didn't think they could see it themselves any more than Darwin ever thought in his lifetime he could see it. But they found from their first measurements that Darwin's finches are incredibly variable birds. As it happens, and Darwin himself couldn't know this, but as it happens, they're some of the most variable animals in the wild. I mean, it is bizarre how variable they are. Some of my students are here tonight. Actually, my entire seminar is here from the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism, and I thank you all for coming. And now I just completely diverted myself from wherever I was going.
The incredible variation of the finches.
Thank you. The incredible variation of the finches. They found that the beaks of the birds, for instance, vary by as much of as a millimeter within the population. So that sounds tiny to us, but we're talking about birds about the size of the sparrows of New York City. In fact, they look a little like the sparrows of New York City. And their beaks are far more variable than the beaks of the sparrows of New York City. Oh, I know where I was going. I have two excellent birders in my class who know more about this than I would know. So these birds are really variable. Variation is showcased by these birds. So if you're going to start with variation, then this is an amazing place to look for it in Darwin's finches. And the variations are inherited. So how did the Grants know that? They had to go back to this desert island again and again, year after year, and trace the birds.
Oh, thanks, Kendall.
They had to trace the birds' family trees.
And that meant climbing up on boulders, lava boulders on this desert island, and peeking into the nests of the Opuntia cactus. The finches would build their nests high up in the cactus. And putting little bands, colored bands, on each baby finch and making careful notes so that they knew who its mama was, who its papa was, and doing that generation after generation. And you have to picture, I can't move away from this microphone or I would draw it somewhere, but the island is shaped, it's a cinder cone sticking up out of the Pacific, and it's as steep as a roof all the way around. So if you, the grant students call it the biggest ashtray in the world. You know, if you picture a classic hotel ashtray just floating in the middle of the Pacific, you've got it.
When one of their students, Lyle Gibbs, once climbed up to peek into a finch nest so that he could band the baby finches, he fell.
He rolled down the island. Then he fell off the cliff because the volcano is surrounded by cliffs that the waves have worn away all around. He landed in the Pacific among the sharks
because the island is surrounded by sharks.
And then he had to swim halfway around the island. Oh, thanks a lot, Phil. All right. Apologies to those of you who are listening, and I'm going to draw a picture of this
extraordinarily forbidding island. It's like a Jules Verne
forbidding island. Might almost have inspired him.
So there's the Pacific, looking Pacific, looking peaceful. Here is Daphne Major, and the cliffs are like that all the way around.
Steep.
Very steep. Very steep. Steep as a roof.
All right. I don't know if that was worth the
the audiovisual effort.
But the point about the cliffs is important. If I were a better artist, you would get the feel for those cliffs. Because the Pacific is usually not Pacific. In fact, Darwin, who was always seasick, complained about this in his letters home. Miscalled Pacific, he said. the waves, if you are on a little Zodiac heading for this island because there's no place to dock, the waves are lifting you halfway to the ceiling and then dropping you down to the floor below us. And you have to time your jump from the Zodiac onto this little block of basalt that I call, ironically in the book, the welcome mat. The Grants do not call it the welcome mat. And then you have to climb up a trail, a very steep trail, to the cinder cone, to the one place that's flat enough and sandy enough to pitch a camp, to pitch a tent. And the Grants began doing this, as I say, in 1973, and brought their two little girls with them and raised these two little girls on Daphne Major and in several other islands in the Galapagos. And they participated in the banding of the birds. And what the Grants were seeing was so exciting to them that they seemed to have focused almost exclusively on the beaks of the finches and hardly ever on the faces of their little girls. I'm not saying they were badly brought up. They're very happy kids. They now have very happy families. But if you look at the slides of Peter and Rosemary Grant and their family, you see finches and finch beaks, variation from one finch to the next, and at the Grant's retirement party at Princeton last fall, about a year ago, Nicola Grant said that she was trying to find slides of the family on this desert island for the retirement occasion, and the closest she could come was a picture that showed her hand holding one of Darwin's finches.
That was it.
So that's why there are no photographs in the beak of the finch, actually. Anyway, they start watching Darwin's finches, documenting this variation from generation to generation, and they still don't believe that they're going to be able to see Darwin's argument in action until a drought year came in 1977. And in 1977, at the start of the year, there were 1,200 Geospiza fortis, which are medium-beak ground finches, on Daphne Major. And I'm rounding that number. The Grants have the exact number. And, of course, they know who those birds' parents and grandparents and great-grandparents were. At the start of the year, 1,200 fortis. By the end of the year, only 180 survived on Daphne Major, a loss of 85%. Of the survivors, it was not a random sample. Of the survivors, it was the bigger birds with the bigger beaks that made it through. Not longer beaks, not wider beaks. Selection favored a deep and narrow beak among Geospiza fortis that year. And the reason was tribulus seeds. Tribulus, from tribulare, Latin for trouble. These are seeds with terrible spikes, terrible if your beak is measured in millimeters. They're seeds that are encased in a thick coat and that have these spikes like caltrop. If anybody's a fan of medieval armor, you know caltrop. Those were the spiky, the ball with spikes that people would whirl around as a mace or that they would, yeah? That they would, I'd see some nods.
Some collegiate kids.
Yeah, that's right. These seeds, independently of medieval knights, invented caltrop, and they are the bane of the existence of most medium-beak ground finches on Daphne, except those lucky ones that happen to be born with a longish, narrowish, strong beak. Those are the only ones that are able to crack a tribulus seed because they can get their beak in between the spikes, and then they're strong enough to be able to crack the coat. So it's like the last pistachio nuts. As the drought is going on, everybody else has cracked all the easy seeds on the island. The last pistachio nuts, the one you need the nutcracker for at the bottom of the bowl, only those fortunate few
with the right beak at the right time, were able to get a meal by the end of that year. And that's why they were the ones that survived. Only 15 in 100. Well, among GSB zifortis, as among many animal species, the males tend to be bigger than the females. That's a phenomenon called sexual dimorphism, and evolutionary biologists study that, the reasons for it, why might it have evolved. It's a general rule among fortis. So the result is that at the end of the drought, there are many more males that have survived than females. In fact, 6 times more females have survived than males. That means that when the rains finally came at the end of that drought year, and the island suddenly turned green again, and the birds began to sing on the cactus trees, the males sing to attract the females, and then the females fly around and check them out, listen to the song, check out the height of the perch on the cactus tree, and apparently check out the beaks of the male birds, too. They had their pick. The females had their pick of the males because there were six times as many males as there were females. So that was an episode, of what Darwin called sexual selection. And sexual selection operated again with uncanny intensity at that moment among Darwin's finches. So you have birds that are remarkably variable, that have gone through a remarkably intense selection event, very, very tough drought, and are now the largest with just those beaks being selected with remarkable intensity by sexual selection and natural selection. They breed, they pass on their genes. The next generation is strikingly larger and has a striking number of these excellent tribulus cracking beaks all over Daphne Major. It's such a striking change that you can see it with the naked eye on Daphne Major from one year to the next, although, of course, the grants and their grad students and their students have collected all these numbers and crunched them in computers. They have supercomputers that can crunch the toughest. I'm making a little pun here, but I'm not going to pursue it. But they found that, in fact, they had seen evolution in action. And that is the theme of Chapter 4 of The Origin, Natural Selection or the Survival of the Fittest. The birds had undergone natural selection, survival of the fittest, then this bout of sexual selection. The variations had been inherited, and you had a striking evolutionary change. I'm happy to say that a few years later in 1983, it was a Nino year, El Nino made the island incredibly wet, and suddenly, within a week, it was covered with grass. It rained so much that the birds bred and bred generation after generation. There were many generations within that one wet year, and the pressure is now reversed. And can anybody guess why they might have reversed during that wet year? They could eat other seeds. Good. That's right. And grass seeds, which had covered the lava, hid the tribulus seeds. So if you were a big-bodied bird with a big nutcracker beak, this is relatively speaking compared to all your neighbors and cousins, you couldn't get those tribulus seeds. And a big-bodied bird needs a lot more seeds to sustain it. The little guys who had the equipment to crack those little grass seeds were the ones who ate and ate and ate, and the big guys were at a disadvantage. And I, as not representing one of the big guys of my species, I'm always happy to say that the pendulum swung the other way. And now it was the little guys with those grass seed beaks that were favored by natural and sexual selection. And this
little two-step that the birds had taken in one direction, they now reversed and danced in the other direction within a matter of a couple of years. So that's only one of hundreds, literally hundreds of episodes of evolution in action that the Grants and their students and now many other biologists are documenting in the islands. And they have demonstrated with fantastic precision that variation can be a matter of life and death, that the smallest grain in the balance really can determine who shall live and who shall die, and that it can produce evolutionary change. And if climate changed in a way that didn't swing back pendulum-like from one state to another, from wet to dry, if, for instance, one imagines these birds arriving in the Galapagos for the first time some millions of years ago, blown off course, perhaps in a Niño year from South America, blown way out to sea, landing in those islands, they arrived in a situation very different from the one in which their ancestors had lived and flourished. They were under selection pressure at least as great as those Fortis are on Daphne Major today in the swings of climate, only the climate didn't swing the way it's doing now. For them, conditions remained extremely, severely different from the rainforest of Ecuador, what is now Ecuador, from South America, where they had, where their ancestors lived. In, I think, I hope I'm remembering this right, in a matter of 20 successive steps as large as that one that I just described in the drought of 77, you would have built a bird as different one from the next as the median beak ground finch to the large beak ground finch on Daphne Major. You would have gone from one species to another. Or if the pressures were all the other way, you would have gone to the small beak ground finch. There are now, from that ancestral colony, which consisted maybe of just one pregnant finch, we don't know, that would have done it. From that ancestral colony, there are a baker's dozen of species of Darwin's finches in the islands. So, I'm trying to decide how much time we have and whether I can tell you a little more about the beauty of this variation. You can now go down to the level of the DNA with Darwin's finches, which you couldn't do when I was writing about Peter and Rosemary, to my sorrow. I hoped that I would be able to back in the early 90s, and the tools weren't really there yet. But a few years ago, Peter and Rosemary began collaborating with a group of molecular biologists at Harvard, led by Cliff Tabin. And they did the study that I dreamed that the Grants would do while I was writing about them. They looked at the level of the genes to trace the variation to the level of the genes and see what is being selected for at that ultimate level of variation. And they found a signaling molecule called bone morphogenetic protein 4.
Is that going to be on the test?
Yes, it is. BMP4, write it down. Finches with bigger beaks tend to have more BMP4. And finches with smaller beaks have less BMP4. And in the lab, these biologists were able to demonstrate using chicken eggs, that they could sculpt the beaks themselves by adding or subtracting BMP4. There are other genes involved. There's a protein called calmodulin, a gene for that. There's something called, this won't be on the test except extra credit, tertiforin melanin cumosphorus. All of these genes sculpt the beaks of the finches, and the same genes sculpt the human face in the womb. So Darwin said in The Origin, light will be thrown on the origin of man and his history. We begin to see how our species could have evolved from a collection of perhaps dozens of close relatives in Africa, as close or closer than Darwin's finches are one to the next in the Galapagos Islands. You've heard about the recent discovery of Ardipithecus. She was a hominid who lived 4.4 million years ago in what's now Ethiopia. She was recognizably to us human-like. She was also recognizably what we think of as ape-like. She looks like something like a cross, say, between a chimpanzee and a human being. She weighed about 110 pounds, according to the paleontologist. She stood about 4 feet high. The family lines that evolved into modern humans and chimpanzees shared an ancestor 6 to 7 million years ago. And there are some hints of two splits between our lineages. According to the readings of the DNA and the reconstructions there, there was a split, an initial split, then there was interbreeding between the two populations, and then a second split. The Grants are seeing that kind of splitting and then hybridization and fusing again and then splitting again among Darwin's finches. It's one of the most extraordinary aspects of their studies of the finches, and it may lie in the distant beginnings of our own family line. All that action took place in Africa at about the same time as it was taking place in this young candelabra of Darwin's finches, because the Galapagos Islands arose as volcanoes between 1 million and 9 million years ago. And the differences in DNA between human beings and our nearest relatives today, the chimpanzees, are about the same as the differences between a tree finch and a ground finch. Mm-hmm. Artie had a muzzle that was vaguely ape-like, but it didn't project quite as much as it does the muzzle in the faces of modern African apes. Her nose was pretty flat like theirs. It wasn't yet beaks like our human beaks. And that variation was shaped by BMP4. After Artie, there was another huge change as our brains expanded and expanded very dramatically. Molecular biologists are reading stories in the genes that govern that too. And Darwin himself recognized that characters, as he called them, aspects of a species that evolved relatively recently, tend to be more variable than others. So it's that recency that explains the variability of Darwin's finch beaks, and that explains the extraordinary variation of human brains from one to the next, and of minds even more than brains. I could go on a little bit more about that. Actually, let me just read you a little passage about that from The Beak of the Finch that explains it well, I think. 287.
Open your books, please.
Yeah. So he talks about this theme. I'm doing this because I saw some frowns. You were trying to grasp that point, which is a subtle one that he's making about extra variability in characters of recent origin. He develops this theme in The Origin in a chapter titled Laws of Variation under the heading A Part Developed in Any Species in an Extraordinary Degree or Manner in Comparison with the Same Part in Allied Species Tends to Be Highly Variable. And here Darwin cites the beaks of domestic pigeons when the beak is part of what distinguishes the breed. This pattern holds across nature. The beaks of Darwin's finches have turned out to be a particularly dramatic case. No other character in Darwin's finches is as variable as the beak. In our own species, it's the human brain that has diverged most dramatically from those of our nearest relatives on the tree of life. True to Darwin's law, the human brain is exceedingly variable in its measurements, like the beaks of Darwin's finches, pigeons, and crossbills. The volume of the human skull, its cranial capacity, is more variable than the depth of Geospiza fortis beaks on Daphne major. The mind is our beak, and the human mind is even more variable than the brain. And then I go on to talk about Darwin's own regrets about mathematics. He was lousy at mathematics, and he was brilliant at so many kinds of reasoning and lousy at mathematics. He's a hero to many of us for that. So that's one of the reasons that he was able to write a book like The Origin of Species, because he couldn't use mathematics well. So he puts it all into words, and he puts it all into words that anybody can understand and that still make good reading today. So Darwin, toward the end of The Origin, theorized, "The chief cause of our natural unwillingness to admit that one species has given birth to clear and distinct species is that we are always slow in admitting great changes of which we do not see the steps. Today, we can see the steps. Darwin is alive and well and living in the Galapagos. And yet so many do close their minds to all this fabulous variation and fabulous adventure of selection, of struggle, and of success generation by generation." So why is that so hard to take? Why is this story so hard to take? That's a question I want to leave you with. It, to me, is one of the most beautiful stories in all of human culture. It's one of the great discoveries of science, certainly, and it's one of the great achievements of human beings that we have been able to reconstruct so much and see so much and discover it still in action now among us. I remember that line in The Voyage of the Beagle. "It is the fate of most voyagers no sooner to discover what is most interesting in any locality than they are hurried from it." So how wonderful that our own kind has seen at least this much of our story, which must be the most interesting story on planet Earth. Right, thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much, Professor Wiener. What a lovely talk. We want to go to questions. Before we do that, I want to remind the people who are listening remotely, please email me, pterry@readingodyssey.com, with your questions, and we'll get to as many of them as possible. We're going to start with a question here at Columbia from the live audience. So who would like to add a comment or a question? Yes. And why don't you go ahead and stand up and just state your name and where you're from and ask Professor Wiener the question.
I'm Sam Levison. I'm a senior at the Collegiate School.
Sam, speak loudly, because it turns out I don't think we have microphones for the audience, so just right. So the people on the phone can hear you.
All right. So as I can see from your book, you know, you put a lot of weight on observation and drawing conclusions from that observation. In sort of researching Darwin and evolution as a whole, did you take into account influences from other disciplines and other literature, such as Malthus and Smith, in sort of coming up with the concept of natural selection?
Good question. So
and restate it again.
I will.
Okay.
Is Darwin's story, as I tell it, as everyone tells it, puts a lot of emphasis on Darwin's powers of observation, extraordinary powers of observation that he had. His description of the Galapagos Islands is still the best description ever written. He was, at the same time, an amazing scholar who was very interested in the work of other natural historians before him and around him. He corresponded. His letters are still being published, and they're, I don't know what now, 15 thick volumes and more. So
Yes, I dipped into that literature. I waded through that literature as much as I could in writing The Beak of the Finch. And I was fascinated to see how much research Darwin did himself, not only firsthand research, but also in interviewing and in reading. He was absolutely an astonishing interviewer, among other things. Since we're at the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism, I should say he's not only a model scientist, he's a model scholar, journalist, reporter, and writer. Does that answer your question? Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Sam. We're going to go to one more question here from the live audience, and I want to remind those on the phone, please email questions to pterry@readingodyssey.com. Yes, go ahead. Stand up and again, say your name and speak loudly.
I'm Tim Kelly from the Collegiate School as well. Earlier on, you mentioned how at the dinner table and also just in society around the room, you can see variation in people. And you also mentioned at one point how variation decides who's going to be able to pass on their genes and create the next generation.
Or it can decide it.
Yeah. But what I was wondering is even in today's society where everyone, it seems, passes on their traits, at least in a large portion of the world, do you feel like that's still really the case for humans? Because it feels like even under these conditions, there's really no sexual or environmental pressures that you talked about in regards to consensus for others.
It's a really good question. Again, the question is, in our fortunate time in our species, when so many people don't have to wonder whether they'll make it through the year because of a drought or a flood year, is there the same natural selection pressure on us? It's certainly there. It is far less intense right now. So what we're living in for our species right now is the equivalent of an absolutely terrific year on Daphne Major. That doesn't mean that any of this argument applies less to us. It only means that we're in a lucky time when most of us are able to survive and pass on our genes. Even now, though, there is a surprising amount of natural selection taking place, unseen, generally unseen. Apparently, many times when sperm meets egg and the egg implants in the uterus, the embryo spontaneously aborts very, very early on. Because there are defects, there are slight variations in that embryo. The mother may not even be aware that she was pregnant. That is natural selection as intense as anything we're talking about in the Galapagos, when you think about it. Those were variations that became, the smallest grain in the balance, became a matter of life and death. So it still goes on in our species as it does in every other, but we're in, for many, many millions of people on the planet now, we're in a very fortunate time. I should add that there are never any guarantees that a species that is flourishing will continue to flourish with the same success, and that there are times when, even in nature, one can be too clever for one's own good. There is a cautionary tale that the Grants uncovered in the Galapagos that reminds me a little bit of our own peril on planet Earth in consuming so much of the world's resources so quickly. There are cheaters among the cactus finches. The cactus finches make their living by sticking their beaks into cactus flowers and getting the pollen and getting the nectar. Actually, they're after the nectar. They get pollen on their beaks. They fill the niche that bees play here on the mainland. There are some cactus finches that have discovered that a nuisance the stigma that stick out of the flowers and poke them in the eye when they reach in with their beaks to try to get at the nectar, that nuisance can be got rid of if they snip the stigma with their beaks. So they fly to these flowers early in the morning before anybody else when the flowers have just begun to open. They snip the stigmas, and then they drink the nectar. That sterilizes the flower. That means that those cheaters begin to destroy the resource, the one resource that will keep them alive on Daphne Major. And the grants have found that it's a significant problem for the cacti on Daphne Major. In fact, there is a chance if that behavior became too common on Daphne that the cactus finches would drive themselves extinct. So a little note of preaching there, because we are certainly to planet Earth treading at least as heavily right now as the cactus finches on the cactus at Daphne.
Great. Thank you. Good question, and certainly one that comes up quite often. I want to go, we're getting lots of questions from folks remotely, and I want to remind you, keep sending those in. We have a relationship with the Arizona State University Ask a Biologist program, which means that any questions that you send in tonight that we don't get to, we will send to Ask a Biologist, and we'll get answers to all of them and post them up on our website. I want to forward a question from Jack Brownell. He's actually one of the readers in the Darwin Origin of Species reading group, which we have running now. And I want those on the phone as well as those in the live audience to know that while the group started last night and actually read Variations Chapters 1 and 2, it is not too late to join if you want to be a part of that group. It is a free reading group led by a teaching fellow at Harvard who's a terrific moderator. Email me if you want to be a part of that. So Jack Brownell, who's a physicist from Los Alamos Laboratory and is reading Origin of Species for the first time in many years, he talked about it last night that he had read it in undergrad but hadn't paid given it the due attention that it deserved. He asked a question on a specific issue, so let me share this with you, Professor Wiener, see if you know this. Talking about variation via, quote, conditions of life acting directly on an organism, he notes it was mentioned in Chapter 1 of Origin as one of two ways that variation could occur. He wanted to know if you could comment on the controversy early in the 20th century of Austrian biologist Paul Kammerer, who presented data which seemed to support the inheritance of acquired characteristics in the midwife toad. At the time, he was attacked as a fraud, and even more recently, but a recent Newsweek article says he was probably correct. Do you know what he's talking about, and can you talk to that?
I didn't see the Newsweek article. I'd be very interested to see if Kammerer's being resurrected. I know that was an enormously controversial episode early in the 20th century with Kammerer and the midwife toad. And the reason it touched such a nerve is that Darwin himself, as we know, was confused in the 19th century about the nature of inheritance. And he didn't really know how these variations could be passed down from generation to generation. He didn't know about genes. He didn't know about DNA. And he thought that it might be possible that one's experiences in life could then shape one's offspring, shape one's kids. So the classic example is that the blacksmith will have kids with strong arms because he spent his life at the forge. And we laugh at that now, but in fact, it was a tough problem to try to sort through in Darwin's day. And you've all heard of Lamarck, who argued that, in fact, these acquired characters were the primary driver of evolutionary change. So Darwin allows that might be possible. He says natural selection among variations, he believes, is the primary moving force of evolution, but not the exclusive force. And Kammerer and others have tried to show that acquired characteristics might matter. So I'll take a look at that article, and I'll be very interested to see what the evidence is for restoring honor to Kammerer. I think it was Lauren Isley, or was it Kessler, Alfred Kessler? No, it was Kessler. But one of the great science writers of the first half of the 20th century wrote a whole book about that. And that will be worth tracking down, particularly if this story reignites. Be very interesting to see.
Great. Well, why don't we say that maybe you can write back to me, and we'll post it up on the website. Your further.
I'll be happy to do that.
Answer to that question. I have another many questions coming in remotely. I'm going to ask one more of those, and I think there were one or two questions over here, so I'll get to those in a moment in the live room. But this is something near and dear to your heart. Professor Wiener, Cindy Gresham writes in from Pasadena, Texas, and I want to note that we have found with the Darwin 150 campaign that some of our most passionate supporters are actually in what they like to call the great state of Texas. So Cindy asks, for a high school student who might be interested in science writing, what writers or resources would you recommend as an introduction to the field? She's greatly enjoying the lecture and really loved your book, The Beak of the Finch.
That's so nice. Thanks, Cindy. I would recommend an excellent book by Richard Dawkins, which maybe you've already read if you've gotten to mine. It's called The Blind Watchmaker by Dawkins, D-A-W-K-I-N-S. Richard Dawkins is currently famous for a bestseller arguing for atheism. And I think if you know about that, you should just set that aside, as Darwin himself set those questions aside, and focus on the beautiful exposition that he makes of Darwin's process in The Blind Watchmaker. It's a terrific book. I think it's like Darwin's own writing, exquisitely clear, and lays out Darwin's argument in a way that becomes absolutely vivid, simple, and graspable. And once you've grasped this vision, it changes your life.
Great, great. Now let me ask, did someone over here have a question? Did I see a hand earlier? No, I guess I'm making that up. Okay. Oh, it turns out, yes. Can you just to give us your name?
Sure, yeah, I'm David. I'm a student at Johnson. So you may have addressed this or begun to address this, but one thing I've never understood is I think you said that the beak of the finch is the most variable part of the finch. Why should it be the case if variability is blind, I guess, it happens, and is later selected for, that you would notice, that you wouldn't find sort of random variation in other parts of the body at the same time?
That's a good question. So just to repeat it, I've been saying that the beaks of the finches are more variable than any other part, but David asks, why would that be, and why shouldn't there be random variation throughout the body of the bird? There is random variation throughout the body of the bird, and the grants measure that variation. They measure weight, they measure wingspan, they measure everything down to the size of the hallux, which is the big toe of the finch, and they find variation everywhere. But these birds evolved their extremely varied toolkit of beaks quite recently, and those variations, I wonder if I'm going to be able to explain this succinctly without having tried to explain it in some time, they changed more than other parts of the bird because those were the variations that made the difference between life and death. It wasn't so much what the size of your big toe was, for instance, in the drought of 77, what mattered was having that life-giving beak that could crack the tribulus seeds. So those features of the bird, those beaks, those characters as they're known in the jargon, were the ones that were shaped most dramatically by evolution and end up more variable. And that's not a great explanation. I will have to think more about that.
On a genetic level, are you saying that parts of the genome sort of heat up and become more variable? No.
No, it's not that, although you do, I'm sorry, I'll repeat the question. David's saying, is it that parts of the genome heat up and become more variable? It isn't that. I'm having trouble reconstructing this part of the argument. I know that recently evolved characters that set one species apart from another tend to be much more variable. I don't believe that it's because there's more mutation taking place generation by generation in those features. For instance, BMP4 isn't more variable than isn't mutating faster. That does happen actually in bacteria in something called the SOS response. Bacteria under stress will become more variable and mutate faster, and it's part of their ability to adapt to changing conditions. But, David, I know I'll see you in class tomorrow morning. I'll try to have a more cogent, detailed explanation for you then. But it's a fascinating question that it relates not only to the finch beaks, but also, as I said before, to the human brain, which is, again, a feature that sets us apart from our nearest relatives as strikingly as the finch beaks set them apart and is strikingly variable. So that's half an answer.
Great. Let's go to another question from the remote audience. This is, I'm actually waiting. Let's see if it's come in here. I'm just waiting for his official title. I think he just wrote to me. Well, I won't have it now, but I'll share that with you in a bit. This is Anil Kumar Chawla, who is actually the professor in India who is working with the Darwin 150 campaign and has put together a group of professors and universities in India who've been participating with their students in our lecture series. It's been great, and he's just actually put together an ad that's going to run in this Indian biology journal that many thousands of professors there see about what we're doing here. Anyway, he's been a great supporter. He does, first of all, note that it was Arthur Kessler's, who was author of The Case of the Midwife Toad, which he does recommend as a wonderful piece of nonfiction, perhaps to the earlier question. But he says that he gets a question a lot in his classes from students that he thought it'd be interesting for you to speak to, which is related to also the earlier question that we got, I think, from, it was Sam, I believe, from the Collegiate School. What's the future of the human species for the rise of new species in the wake of available variations in the global population?
Hmm.
He gets this a lot and would like to hear what your thoughts are.
That's a great question. Because our gene pool, the human gene pool, is now a global gene pool, because there's so much mixing from one continent to the next, one island to the next, we are not going to see the evolution of a new human species on planet Earth as long as we remain a global civilization. You can imagine some generations from now, if we do become citizens of an age of space, which seemed likely to my generation when I was growing up, if there are colonies on the moon, colonies on Mars, if there are space colonies heading to the nearest star from the sun, which I think is Alpha Centauri, then those generations, breeding generation after the next, could accumulate enough variations, enough differences, that they, if reunited,
with people here on planet Earth would no longer want to interbreed, just as our species and chimpanzees don't have great sexual interest in each other anymore. You would imagine the citizens of Alpha Centauri would have the same feeling of repulsion or distance on revisiting planet Earth. So that's the only way, virtually the only way, you can imagine a new human species arising at present. There is one other way, which I explore in a book of mine called His Brother's Keeper. It occurred to me in the course of writing that book and hanging around with molecular biologists that slight variations in the genes can produce incompatibilities that will prevent sperm from fertilizing egg and producing viable offspring. That's probably one of the causes of those spontaneous abortions we were talking about a moment ago. If somebody were to engineer, this would be a perverse act, and it's hard to imagine why it would ever be done, but just as a thought experiment, follow me a minute. If somebody were to engineer the DNA of, say, 100 human males and females so that they could only be fertile with each other and not with anyone else on the planet, then they would be isolated, not geographically but reproductively isolated, the way one species is from the next. And in fact, by some definitions, they would then constitute a new human species. If those 50 boys and girls grew up and had children, they would be the only people on the planet with whom they could successfully have children, those 50 and 50, then in theory, they could be the start of a new human species. So in the book, I describe this as a sort of a thought or nightmare experiment. But I don't see why that wouldn't be at least a possible origin. That kind of experiment was done here at Columbia with fruit flies, and it works with flies. It would work with people.
Great. Other questions here? Okay. All the way in the back, and then we'll see if we can back to you. Again, stand up. Just give us a...
Yeah. Bill Bullard, I'm a teacher at the school. And I read your book several times, enjoyed it very much. And the first time I read it, it was lit. It was suspenseful because you did this wonderfully vivid job of describing adaptation and variation and adaptation and all the things that Darwin observed. And I was hoping that you were going to get to a speciation event. And of course, that didn't happen. In fact, really, the opposite happened. There was branching and reproductive isolation under stress, and then under times of plenty and the El Nino event, there was all this hybridization collapse of the population. So I'm wondering if that was, for Darwin, speciation was also largely an inference, necessary inference. And I'm wondering if that became sort of Grant's issue at all, that they had in that, well, it's only 30 years, but that they never observed something like speciation.
An excellent question. Were the Grants ever frustrated that they saw what's known in the jargon as microevolutionary change? They never saw the big jump that would constitute the origin of a new species of finch in the islands. And no, they weren't. I mean, you have to remember where their starting point was. They didn't think you could watch evolutionary change at all in their lifetimes. So to see as much change as they are, that has been an extremely exciting experience for them, and it continues to be. I imagine they'll be crunching the numbers even in their retirement now for years and years. It would have been too much to expect, I think, that you would see the origin of a new species in a study. As you say, only 30 years or so. When they're judging by the fossils, there hasn't been a new species in the islands in at least 10,000 years. These birds probably evolved. This little family tree of finches, long before those 10,000-year-old fossils that are as far back as you can go. In lava islands, you can't go back very far, apparently. There isn't that much soil. There aren't that much preserved bones. They're mostly in owl pellets. So thanks to owls that caught finches and then dropped owl pellets in lava caves, we can see what species of finches were around 10,000 years ago. That's about as far back as we can go. No new species in that time. It's not likely we'll see them in our lifetime.
Great. Well, we have one comment and a question that I'm going to call on from the remote audience. First of all, I want to note that George from Georgia, not the state but the country, writes in. Thank you for such a good lecture. I'm a guy who's listening to you from so far away a place. And he notes that most of the population has no idea about evolution and that there are many who have a deep belief that it's an awful mistake. So he really appreciates the lecture, and he says, very good and funny story about the laptop with the chapter inside. All right. So thank you, George. Thank you for calling in. And I did send you a note back asking you how you heard about it, so I look forward to hearing that. And please invite other Georgians to call in and participate in future lectures. Oh, by the way, I did want to note, as we addressed Professor Wiener, at one point you referred to Lamarck in your remarks, and you referred to the intellectual milieu before Darwin. Well, the first lecture that was given by Professor Everett Mendelssohn at Harvard was about the world before Darwin. And he talks at length about Lamarck and that whole intellectual milieu. So if you want more information on that, that entire lecture is available through both podcast and webcast on our website. So please go visit that. Irv Edelman has written in from Colorado. He had got his PhD in genetics from the University of Wisconsin at Madison, which is great. Sean Carroll, who's at the University of Wisconsin at Madison and a leader in what's called evolutionary developmental biology, will be speaking in our third lecture. Irv was asking that and noting that he thought it was generally observed that there's more variability in any trait among the members of any particular generation than there is variability in that trait from one generation to the next.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what routinely makes evolution so difficult to observe in real time. Is this at odds with the observations among finchbeaks that you related in your lecture?
Good question again. So if I understand the question correctly, what he's saying is there tends to be more variation within a population, within each generation, than you see from one generation to the next. So, for instance, if you take Daphne's Geospes apportus, those medium-beak ground finches that are the Grant's favorite birds for study in the islands, there would have been a lot of variation, certainly at the start of that year, 1977, for instance. A lot of variation among those birds. There would have been birds with big beaks, little beaks, skinny, you know, sort of Dr. Seuss, big fish, little fish. There would have been a lot of variation there. The change then to the next generation, their offspring, their kids, would have been relatively small compared to that enormous amount of variation that you see within that generation. Does that make sense? So then that would make it harder to see the change, the statistically, the change that you could see statistically when you crunch the numbers might not be visible to the naked eye. That's, I think, what the drift of the question. And that's very often the case on Daphne and in any population. But that particular episode was so striking that you could, I'm told, see it with the naked eye. Then, of course, the Grants and their students go home, and they do crunch the numbers, and they publish charts and graphs and figures, and they have it all beautifully laid out, number by number and finch by finch. So even very subtle changes you can see. By the way, that's one of the things, the subtle things that they're hoping to sort out. I remember one of the Grants students told me this, that in the Grants' retirement, I have to ask them if they're now doing this, one of the subtle things that they might be able to find is, I told you that they banned all the birds so they can know who its parents and grandparents, et cetera, going back now 20 generations and more. Well, they use color codes. Well, what if there's a subtle fashion sense among these birds? And some colors are a little more popular than others, some combinations of colors. That kind of thing you certainly couldn't see, but it might be something they could pick up if they really crunch the numbers.
That's great. We're going to do one last question here in the room, and then we'll wrap up. And I think you have waited patiently. No? You'll pass? Anybody else in the room want to ask? Okay, great. Well, the last question will be from me then to you. First of all, again, thank you. And I would like you to, first of all, if you haven't read Beak of the Finch, immediately go buy it.
I thank you.
It is the book that, as an adult, I read that started me on this process of learning much more about evolution and biology. It really inspired me, and it's just a terrific, terrific book. So my question to you is, you are working on a book now. Why don't you tell us just a little bit about that and when we can expect to see it in the bookstores?
Sure. My class is laughing because I've been angsting to them about the title, which I won't disclose at this time. But I am writing a book that grows out of time I spent hanging around with molecular biologists after the Beak of the Finch. One of them, an extraordinary elderly biologist named Seymour Benzer, had in his late 70s developed an interest, I wonder why, in aging. He had become interested in aging the way he was interested in genetic variations in families back when he was a young father and was noticing how different his second daughter was from his first. That had moved him to study variation in human personality and variations even in fly personalities at the level of the genes. It's an amazing story because he found a lot. So in his old age, he decided he would look for Methuselah mutants. And at the age of 80, he published the discovery of a Methuselah fly, which lives an astonishingly long lifespan, measured in weeks beyond the lifespan of an ordinary mortal fly. That kind of research is now going on all over the world and is making headlines all over the world. There have been stories in the New York Times, 3 or 4 in the last 2 weeks, I think, about the biology of longevity. So as I get a little bit older myself, I've become interested in the subject. I can tell you that this beard was brown when I started the book, and it is now gray. So I'm almost done, and the book should come out in June.
Great. Kendall, why don't you?
Yeah, and before we thank Jonathan, which I promise we're going to do, I just want to remind everyone that we have 3 more lectures in this series. On November 4th, we will be at the University of Wisconsin with Professor Sean Carroll, and we actually have 2 lectures on November 24th, which is a very important date. It's the actual anniversary of the publication of Origin of Species. We have a lecture with E.O. Wilson that begins at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. That is a perfect time for school assemblies on the Tuesday before Thanksgiving. So we're reaching out to teachers about that. And at 6 o'clock that night, a program at the New York Academy of Sciences. Another reminder that all of these lectures are going to be available online. Indeed, there will be video of this lecture within a few days if you'd like to come back and not only hear it again, but see it. Information about our reading groups and our Facebook group at www.darwin150.com. I want to thank our technology partners, Citrix Online and their high-def conferencing division, Campaign Monitor and Squarespace, our sponsors, National Geographic, National Center for Science Education, the New York Academy of Sciences. I want to thank all of the universities and schools and museums who are hosting groups. I want to thank Collegiate School for being right here with us at Columbia tonight. Yay. I want to thank the ragtag group of volunteers, our leader, Phil Terry, who thought up this crazy idea and gets us to all come along. And last but not least, what an honor and what a joy to have Jonathan Weiner tonight. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.